This is Audible.
Star Maker by Olaf Stapledon. Read by Andrew Wincott. Forward. Star Maker is the most wonderful novel I have ever read. It retains its wonder on successive readings and repays study. To put it at its simplest, the story of the book is the story of a quest. But a quest on a cosmic and superhuman scale. The I of the book projects his spirit away from this earth and the world's delirium into the universe to encounter other worlds, other beings, other classes of beings, finally to confront the creator of the universe itself, the Star Maker, and be permitted communication with it. Nothing could be simpler or more ambitious. In his original preface to Star Maker, the author states that this is not a novel at all. True, it more resembles an attempt to create myth on the grandest possible scale. A myth for our time that will appease both the scientist and the mystic in us. That is to say, a myth for the two hemispheres of mankind's divided brain. The nobility of this attempt sets Star Maker apart from both the modern novel and science fiction, which it superficially resembles. The intention is to instruct as well as to entertain, to imagine as well as to synthesize. As we might expect, the author of such an astonishing book is himself something of a mystery. William Olaf Stapledon, 1886 to 1950, has been depicted by some critics as a feeble kind of fellow. On the contrary, I believe he was a man of marked character, an athlete in his youth at Oxford, and certainly a brave man to have embarked on an enterprise as considerable as the present book. He may have had his peculiarities, but an ordinary man in the street would hardly create a work like this. Stapledon was an Englishman whose childhood was divided between England and Egypt, where his father was employed by a shipping line. This pinch of exile probably helped forge the detachment so noticeable in his writing. His first novel, though again the term novel is questionable, was Last and First Men, published in London in 1930. That book won enthusiastic critical reviews and remained Stapledon's most famous work. Yet acceptance even of Last and First Men is as uncertain as Stapledon's reputation, preserved by science fiction readers, those worldly visionaries. It faded from recognition at one time, to be revived only when the present writer persuaded Penguin Books to reissue it with his introduction in 1963. Covering as it does the next 5 billion years, Last and First Men is the most thorough and amazing future history ever written. Yet it was to be eclipsed in virtuosity as well as scale 7 years later, when Star Maker appeared. Star Maker is grander in theme, more felicitous in style, subtler in approach, not to mention more overwhelming in imaginative power. As for Stapledon's courage, at the least he was awarded the Croix de Guerre for his service in World War I, when he worked as an ambulance driver in the mud and muck of Flanders. Ambulance driving was an appropriate occupation, well suited to a man of pacifist inclinations, who nevertheless felt compelled to play a part in that ghastly struggle in which the old centuries were irrevocably severed from the new. The quality of aloofness in Stapledon's character was not of his own choosing. Whatever difficulties the quality brought him in ordinary life, it made him the kind of writer he became. Much though he feared that the war would undermine civilization, as it undoubtedly did, he appreciated that it gave him the chance to work as one with his fellows. In his strange successor to Last and First Men, entitled Last Men in London, Stapledon has his protagonist, Paul, say that he entered the war to accept as far as possible, on the one hand, the great common agony, and on the other, the private loneliness of those who cannot share the deepest passions of their fellows. Star Maker is also chock-a-block with great common agonies and private loninesses, often the private loneliness of entire solar communities. madness akin to loneliness, is often in Stapledon's mind. The endless vistas of galaxy after prodigal galaxy threaten the intellect. As we searched up and down time and space, discovering more and more of the rare grains called planets, we watched race after race struggle to a certain degree of lucid consciousness, only to succumb to some external accident, or more often to some flaw in its own nature. We were increasingly oppressed by a sense of the futility, the planlessness of the cosmos. This somber mood, owing much to the pessimism of Schopenhauer and the conviction that God was dead or an illusion, is more characteristic of the higher thinkers of the late 19th century than the optimistic technophiles of the 20th. There are, however, times when we are reminded that Stapledon explored at a very early date the standby of ambitious science fiction writers from E.E. Smith onward, galactic empires at war. Germinating in regions far apart, these empires easily mastered any sub-utopian worlds that lay within reach. Thus they spread from one planetary system to another, till at last empire made contact with empire. Then followed wars such as had never before occurred in our galaxy. Fleets of worlds, natural and artificial, maneuvered among the stars to outwit one another, and destroyed one another with long-range jets of subatomic energy. As the tides of battle swung hither and thither through space, whole planetary systems were annihilated. Many a world spirit found a sudden end. Many a lowly race that had no part in the strife was slaughtered in the celestial warfare that raged around it. But any similarities between Stapledon's irresistible sweep of events and conventional science fiction is purely coincidental. Stapledon's imagination is omnivorous. After discoursing with the minds of great nebulae, the questing spirit goes on to achieve discourse with the star maker itself. The finely sustained climax of the book is the maker's description of the series of universes with which he is experimenting, of which ours is but one in an almost infinite line. Where does one look in all English prose for a parallel with the magnificent Chapter 15? An introduction should go no further than this in outlining the many astonishments which the reader is to undergo. But it is worth noting one reason why so many readers are unable to confront Stapledon squarely. He is too challenging for comfort. The scientifically minded mistrust the reverence in the work. The religious shrink from the idea of a creator who neither loves nor has need of love from his creations. To my mind, this intransigent position is in fact the delight of the book and proves Stapledon's courage. Like his star maker, Stapledon inculcates a similar independence in his readers. He is not asking to be loved. He does not love. His work is there. We accept it as we will. Because of this admirably Parnassian attitude, Stapledon has influenced few writers directly. To show his influence, a writer must have imbibed him when young and demonstrate in his later writing a sense of cosmic process indifferent to the ambitions of humankind. Arthur C. Clarke has claimed to be influenced by Stapledon, and we may believe him. I also came on his writing early, in the middle of a world war, when that dispassionate voice carried the shock of sanity. Galaxies like grains of sand is imitation Stapledon. The writers who helped form Stapledon's characteristic utterance are most probably philosophical and political writers. There was also, of course, H.G. Wells, 20 years Stapledon's senior. Otherwise, one might name Dante and the author of Paradise Lost. But the most obvious influence appears to be Winwood Reade, the once celebrated author of The Martyrdom of Man, a work published in 1872 and frequently reprinted over the succeeding 80 years. Reade's work ranges freely over the entire history of mankind and is at once scientific and political. Wells described it as an extraordinarily inspiring presentation of human history as one consistent process. It would be this view of life as a process that appealed to Stapledon as it did to Wells. The martyrdom of man roused great antagonism in its time, in the main because of its attack upon religion. Reed did indeed put God in his place, as a passage such as the following suggests. The arithmetical arrangement of the gods depends entirely upon the intellectual faculties of the people concerned. In the period of thing-worship, as it may be termed, every brook, tree, hill, and star is itself a living creature, benevolent or malignant, asleep or awake. In the next stage, every object and phenomenon is inhabited or presided over by a genius or spirit, and with some nations the virtues and the vices are also endowed with personality. As the reasoning powers of men expand, their gods diminish in number and rule over larger areas, till finally it is perceived that there is unity in nature, that everything which exists is a part of one harmonious whole. It is then asserted that one being manufactured the world and rules over it supreme. But at first, the great being is distant and indifferent, a god sitting outside the universe. And the old gods become viceroys to whom he has deputed the government of the world. They are afterwards degraded to the rank of messengers or angels, and it is believed that God is everywhere present, that he fills the earth and sky, that from him directly proceeds both the evil and the good. In some systems of belief, however, he is believed to be the author of good alone, and the dominion of evil is assigned to a rebellious angel or a rival god. This extract is included not only because I hope to find others to share my enthusiasm for Winwood Reed, but because one can see Olaf Stapledon chuckling with appreciation over such downgrading of the deity. Stapledon takes that thought further, light years further. Whatever it may be, novel, myth, prose poem, vision, Starmaker remains light years ahead, something toward which the rest of us are still travelling. Brian W. Aldiss.